Welcome in episode number 108 of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast. Season's over again. Season's over.
Every time this team loses two in a row,
it's over. It's over.
You get the Broncos Avies on Twitter asking when training camp.
Knew this was going to happen. Knew they were going to fall apart. It was over after the National Series on April 27th. The season ended for the first time. Then it was over when they lost two to the Dodgers at Coors Field in May. Then it was over the Mariners series. It was way over. The Pirates series, it was way over. Yeah, man, it sucks. And now it's over again. So what is that, five times? Season's over.
Yeah, Rockies have lost.
Back it in.
You know, the Rockies have lost five of their last, 17 games?
They're 14-6 this month, which is bad, I've been told. Twitter's told me that's bad.
You know, it's ridiculous it's terrible, how a team man. Can lose this many games. No. Five of their last 18.
It's embarrassing.
It's absurd.
It's embarrassing. And with that, we welcome you into this season-ending edition of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast. I'm Tyler Munn.
And I'm Anthony Masterson.
And we got a hell of a good show coming up for you today. Mike Farron, our good buddy from the Arizona Diamondbacks pregame and postgame work, as well as MLB Network Radio, one of the fill-in play-by-play voices for the D-backs as well, and general all-around good guy, Mike Farron, joins the show. He's way smarter than both of us combined, way nicer than both of us combined, a better
you
sense
especially.
Of humor, a better voice. He's fantastic. I love Mike Farron, and he was outstanding today.
Yeah.
He gave us a lot today, so that's coming up in a little bit. Let's dive into this. Thanks for finding the old PDP. We are on iTunes. We're on the Stitcher app. We are working on getting onto Google Play. Because I know that's the latest
fancy
thing with the old Android people. All you weirdos who have Androids.
I have a Samsung.
Oh, well, you're one of them then. You're one of them. Loser. So you might be able to find us there. And while you're doing that, while you're searching, head on to the old internet and go to purpledinosaurpodcast.bigcartel.com. You too can be like Nine News's Kyle Clark and buy your Party Deck Against the World shirt right now, purpledinosaurpodcast.bigcartel.com. We got some more stuff in the works with Humble Monster, which I'm very excited about. Don't you love how everybody else
first,
has jumped
the first
on
the newscast?
Yeah, yeah.
The first newscaster to wear our shirt. I'm hoping for Adele Arakawa one day.
She, I think this week is her last week on television. She's retiring.
Really?
Yeah.
So we got to hurry.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. We do. We have
to get Ron Zappolo.
We got to hustle one over there. Yeah. We could get Ron Zappolo, I bet. Probably not Ringlesby. He's not on television anyway, and also is terrible.
Yeah, I always love waking up in the morning being like, oh, who's Tyler picking a fight with today?
Hey, I didn't pick a fight. Somebody's gonna pick a fight with handicapped people on Twitter.
Yeah.
I'm not picking a fight. That dude picks a fight with the entirety of Twitter. I'm just highlighting that he mocked handicapped people on Twitter today. Not gonna stand for it.
Get ripped on Twitter for doing that or become president of the United States.
Yeah, that's true.
So.
One of the two. I think the cowboy hat would probably disqualify him because people don't disqualify anybody for anything actually meaningful. Remember when Howard Dean yelled once and that was like made him into a national laughingstock? And then another one bragged about sexually assaulting women and now he's president. So, you know, maybe that's the key to it on twitter.com. Just mock the disabled if you're an old white guy sports writer. Twitter has been garbage today. We're recording on Friday morning. It is June 23rd. The season is over, as we have said. So that's all we have to do is pick out bad opinions from old wealthy white guys on Twitter and publicly shame them. It works.
Cool.
It works.
Yeah.
So your Colorado Rockies head into the weekend and the start of a big, big road trip. 9 games through Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Phoenix coming up tonight. The Rockies will take on the Arizona Diamondbacks. Kyle Freeland will go to the hill against Alex Wood. Alex Wood is somehow 7-0 pitcher wins with a sub-2 ERA this year. And Kyle Freeland has been terrific for the Rockies. Freeland coming off of a victory his last time out in that 5-1 win against the Giants on Saturday. The Rockies 5-2 over their 7-game homestand, but the sky has fallen because they won the first 5 and then they lost the last 2. But overall, you know, pretty good homestand when you win 5 out of 7. And they'll head into this series tonight with the Dodgers still right in the heat of it. However, they are now tied for second place, technically in third place via win percentage in the National League West. So it's pretty much all over. Big series coming up.
Yeah. Yeah. Hope they win.
Yeah, it would be nice.
I'm actually going on Sunday, so they better win. And it was supposed to be Clayton Kershaw, and I've never seen Clayton Kershaw pitch in person. And I was like, oh, you know, at least I can see him, you know, rip the spine out of my team in person because, you know, it's one of the best pitchers of our generation. But no, it's going to be Brandon McCarthy instead.
Oh, well, that's good.
I mean, whatever.
Clayton Kershaw goes on Saturday against Tyler Chatwood, which will be an interesting matchup.
I would honestly be totally okay with it if the Rockies lost the series but beat the shit out of Kershaw on Saturday.
Clayton Kershaw, I'm so conflicted on him because sometimes he's so hateable, and then he has moments like last week he told Zach Hampel that he wouldn't give him a ball.
God, yeah, that was awesome.
That was fantastic. If you don't know who Zach Hampel is, you're so much better off, and don't even waste your time looking him up.
He's the ball hawk that everybody knows
about. The worst. Just the worst. But he asked Clayton Kershaw for a ball, and Clayton Kershaw told him no, and he said, why? And he said, you already have like 7,000 of them. And then Zach Hampel went on Twitter and said, but I told him, oh, it's Father's Day. It would mean so much to me. And he still said no. And then he said, by Clayton Kershaw's logic, doesn't that mean that he shouldn't care about his next paycheck? No. Nope. That's not at all how that works. Clayton Kershaw, I'm so conflicted sometimes with him.
Kershaw's been so weird this year. I feel like this year he's been so much more demonstrative.
Yeah, I would agree.
Than in previous
seasons.
He's
really like, kind of faded into the background.
Yeah, he gives up a hit and he like jumps 3 feet off the mound.
Yeah.
And he's like screaming into his glove. It's like, dude, okay, like, you know, we get it. You're the best pitcher in baseball, arguably. Well, what's the deal? What changed this year?
Yeah.
Like the Anderson thing is one thing altogether, but like, I don't understand why he's seemingly much more frustratable this year. And when he's pitching frustrated, he's still very, very good, obviously.
Right.
He's allowed the most home runs in his career in any season already.
And it's the middle of June. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird.
It's interesting.
He has been kind of
I'm
a background
sure exactly
personality in his career. And then this year it's like, okay, not only is he still Clayton Kershaw on the mound for the most part, but he's also like kind of a crazy person personality-wise.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe not.
I don't know. Whatever.
Whatever. We'll talk about that series here coming up in a little bit, but before that, we are going to reflect on the homestand that was. We're going to start things off by talking about the last 2 days. The Rockies blown out by a combined score of 26-8 and losses to Taijuan Walker and Zach Godley on the mound and a roaring Arizona Diamondbacks offense at the plate. Jeff Hoffman got roughed up on Wednesday. Antonio Senzatella got roughed up Thursday afternoon in front of a sellout crowd. I believe this qualifies as, well, not a sellout, but a near sellout. Over 40,600 people in attendance on a Thursday afternoon for a series finale against the Diamondbacks, which is like the least bandwagon team ever, so you can't even blame it on that. Not an encouraging last couple of days, but I will point out that after the Rockies got their genitals kicked in by the Washington Nationals, they bounced back immediately, went on the road to Arizona and took 2 out of 3, and then took 2 out of 3 in San Diego, went 4-2 on a 6-game road trip, then came home, took 2 out of 3 from Arizona, took 2 out of 3 from the Chicago Cubs. So
it's a theme here.
You know, yeah. I think they're probably going to be okay, as we've learned this season, but not a good couple of days. Sure.
No. But, you know, like I said, these days happen. They still went 5-2 on the homestand or whatever. Yeah, 5-2 on the homestand. It's not like the sky is falling. Now, here's the thing with the Rockies issue. We mentioned this before on the podcast and on Twitter. Good teams don't let these streaks become longer. They don't let these 3-game losing streaks become 5, 6, 7-game losing streaks. They don't do that. We mentioned the Indians as the prime example. The Indians haven't had a losing streak of longer than 3 games in almost 2 years. And Lashley went to the World Series because they don't let it continue to snowball on them. And that's what happened with the Rockies a lot in their history. When they've had good starts, they've had these stretches, these road trips where they just everything falls apart. They go on a 9-game road trip, they would go 1-8, or we've seen 0-9. Like it's not something that good teams have happened to them. So that's what the Rockies have done a very good job of this year, is of not letting those things snowball. They've only lost 3 games in a row a handful of times this year, but nothing more. And that's why I think this Friday night game is a very important game, because if they can win tonight, you know, get one of the win column. You got Kershaw going on Saturday. You know, that game's always going to be a tough one. maybe come back and win the series on Sunday. But that's why I think this Friday night game is a very big one, because you lose tonight, they got a three-game losing streak with Kershaw on the hill the next day. That's when you start getting yourself behind the eight ball a little bit. But the Rockies have been excellent this year, and it's up to Kyle Freeland tonight to have a good start. Obviously, you'll be listening to this podcast probably prior to the game. You'll probably be 3 days later. The Rockies probably already have swept the Dodgers at that point, and all this conversation will be moot. But the overarching point is that the Rockies have not let these losses, no matter how big, no matter how crushing, get the best of them this year for a long stretch of time. And that's a testament to the coaching staff.
Yeah, this is a big series in a whole lot of ways. I think we've been conditioned over the last several years to just assume that at some point the sky is going to fall and they're going to end up in last place in the division. This year, A, it's not going to happen because they're a good team. B, it's not going to happen because the Padres and Giants are really, really bad. Yes. But the Los Angeles Dodgers are 29-10 at home this year. They have not started a season 30-10 at home since 1974, I think I saw today. You know, it's a place where not easy to win, but the Rockies, really, it seems like over the last couple of seasons, haven't really shirked away from playing in Los Angeles. Last year, that wasn't a great team by the end of the season, but the Rockies seemed like they held their own pretty well in Los Angeles. They split two games at Dodger Stadium in their one visit there this season. That was all the way back on April 18th and 19th. They got a win in the opener, and then they fell to Kershaw in the finale. Kershaw in the infamous Tyler Anderson game. I think tonight is big. I also think this is we talked about the stretch where the Rockies are going to play 22 of 29 on the road and how pivotal of a stretch that was going to be. This, to me, as big of a stretch as that was to determine that they were real as a team season long, this is the road trip that I think will determine, are they going to be in this race in the division?
The order.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
The order that they could finish.
Right. The Dodgers for three games. The Giants are a garbage heap. But San Francisco is a place that is, you know, historically a tough place for the Rockies to play. And then Arizona you get for the last leg of this trip. And you're going to be a little bit motivated after the fact that they kicked your brains in for 2 days at home. So I think this is kind of a season-defining swing in terms of what the division race is going to look like, what the power structure is going to be in the division.
Well, and especially because if you come through this, let's say they go 4-5, fine. Because the next stretch of schedule for the Rockies, it looks pretty good. You got four against Cincinnati, three against the White Sox, three against the Mets, three against the Padres,
separated
Pirates,
by the All-Star
Cardinals,
break also.
Like, yeah, by the All-Star break, yeah, too. Then you go play the Nationals for three, but then you got the Mets and Phillies again. The month of July, yeah, is going to be a very easy month in terms of the opponents the Rockies are potentially going to play.
Yeah.
So these teams aren't playing well. They're not very good teams, and they're going to be facing them for basically a month straight. The Dodgers right now are in a stretch, a two-month stretch where they play 50 games. 38 of them are against teams with losing records. The Rockies are going to have that basically starting from the end of this road trip and going through basically the middle of August.
Pretty much. I mean, like we said last week, the most that's so Rockies thing for the 2017 Rockies is that they're playing the best ball they've played in franchise history through this point in the season. And also so is everybody else in the division, is what it seems like. Everybody else that matters.
Yes.
The Padres are 29-44. Somehow the Giants are
three games worse.
They're, yeah, three games behind the Padres. The Giants are 27-48. They have the second worst record in the National League. They get swept out of Coors Field. The Rockies have just outclassed the Giants in every matchup so far this season, which is something that you would never have thought possible. The Rockies this year against the Giants are 10-1 with a staff ERA of 3.95. The Rockies as a team are batting .315 against the Giants. Giants ERA against the Rockies is 6.41, and they're batting .259 with a .724 OPS as a team.
It's like a Freaky Friday situation.
Exactly. So
the
Rockies,
they
jumped into the Giants'
during
bodies.
A lightning storm.
Yeah. So it's that's a series you got to go win. But these two in Los Angeles and in Arizona, they're going to speak a lot about what this is going to look like for the next few months.
Yeah. And like, I know everyone's on the Dodgers right now because they've won 13 of 14, blah, blah, blah. In that time, they have taken 4 from the Mets, 6 from the Reds.
Yeah.
And then one from the Nationals and then 2 from the Indians. And the Indians were a 500 team when they played them at that point. Since the Dodgers left town, the Indians have won all but one game. So the Indians weren't even a good team when they played them.
Yeah.
So the Dodgers, yes, they won 13 to 14. They have not beaten anybody good.
They've won 7 straight coming into tonight's matchup with Kyle Freeland going to the hill against Alex Wood.
You got to face two in front of you. You got to beat them, and that's fine.
Right.
They've done a good job of beating them. Good for them. But like, it's not like they're all of a sudden they're world beaters now.
Yeah, there's a little bit of softness to this run for the Dodgers as of late. But the last couple of days, you know, are frustrating because of the way the Rockies lost those games. However, the games prior to that really say more about this team than the last two. They could have lost 2 games easily to the Giants, arguably 3 games to the Giants. They end up winning 10-9 on the 15th of June with the victory coming on the walk-off single by Raimel Tapia. That was in the Thursday opener of that series. They win 10-8 in the second game of that series on Friday. Saturday, they get the 5-1 victory. And then there was Sunday. The Rockies go into the top of the 9th inning, leading the Giants 3-2. They give up 3 runs there. And in the bottom of the 9th, they score 4 times. And Nolan Arenado hits a walk-off 3-run homer on the first pitch of his at-bat against Mark Melancon for not only a walk-off, not only a sweep, but to complete the cycle. I don't know if you've heard about this, folks, but Nolan Arenado.
Have you seen this?
Have you heard about this one, folks? He's pretty good. That moment felt like a transcendent moment in this season. And sure, the Rockies followed it up by losing 2 out of the next 3. Nobody will remember that if they go on, they win the World Series. The way I put it was that when the highlight DVD comes out of this season, if the Rockies go on to win something big, that's the moment that'll get its own segment as this is when we figured out it was all for real. That's what it felt like. That felt like a watershed thing on Sunday afternoon.
It's going to be one of the top 5 most iconic moments in Rockies history. It is Todd Helton in the final of the LCS. It is Dante Bichette with his fist bump on the walk-off in the first game of Coors Field. It's EY Jr. hitting that home run to lead off the bottom of the first at Mile High
Stadium. Ryan Spielberg with the grand slam against the Giants.
It's Ryan Spielberg's grand slam. It is, you know, it is one of the most already iconic moments in Rockies history, and it was immediate that we knew that. It was the first ever 4-game sweep of the Giants they've ever had. Everything was a confluence of all these things coming together with a team that has been so different than others in Rockies history. And to see that moment and to see the passion on Nolan's face, he got cut up by Charlie's helmet in the scrum. He was bleeding. He was running out toward the dugout about to get interviewed. And he was screaming and yelling at all the fans saying, come on, let's do this. This is my city. Like that was the moment that Nolan Arenado put the entire city of Denver on his back. And for the first few years of his career, not that Nolan was kind of in the shadows, of course. He's won the Gold Glove every year. You know, he's been an MVP candidate if the Rockies were any good. But when he first came up, he was kind of in the shadow of Tulo. It was Tulo's team. And then Tulo got traded. Now it's kind of Cargo's team or whatever. That was the moment that Nolan made it his team.
Yeah.
This is Nolan's team. Everyone knows that now. This is Nolan Arenado's team and nobody else's.
Last year, we had Nolan on the podcast, and it was as the Rockies were hanging around in contention toward the end of the 2016 season. Obviously, things fell apart. But I remember having the conversation with Nolan, and my question to him was, I mean, do you guys kind of feel what this is like now to be? I mean, the Rockies were an above 500 team on August 3rd last year. They beat the Dodgers to go to 54-53, and we had Nolan on right around that time. And the question that I asked him was, Is it exciting to you knowing what it's like to sort of be in the race right now and knowing that you have so much more on the way, all these young guys that are coming up through the system, and the fact that this could be the door that's opening? And Nolan kind of paused for a second and was like, yeah, I mean, that's nice, but we're sick of losing, you know, in effect. It's good to be in this situation right now, but we're not thinking about 2017. We're not thinking about 2018. We want to win. This team wants to win. These guys in this clubhouse want to win. And the fact that it was not just we're really excited. The organization, the process has been great. They really got a lot of good stuff coming on. It wasn't that. It was, I've been here 4 years. I'm sick and goddamn tired of losing all the time, and this has to get better for all of us. And then all of a sudden, he's the guy who is the heartbeat of that in 2017 is really, really exciting. And the thing that I think stands out the most to me about it is Tulo was always so non-committal about what it was like to be the cornerstone guy, the face of the franchise, because right. I don't think Tulo was ever comfortable with that being, that's not his personality. He's not the guy no. who wants to be in front of the cameras. He's not a particularly personable, vivacious guy. That's just not Tulo. And that's not a knock on Tulo. Some people just aren't that way.
Or likable.
Yeah. But Nolan,
no one's got a good Tulo story.
Yeah. That's kind of,
that's always been my thing. No one's got a good Tulo story. Is he a great player or was he a great player? Absolutely. Yes. Was he good for the Rockies? Absolutely. Is he a good teammate? Is he a great person?
Debatable.
Ask around. Ask around and see what answers you get.
Don't Let's tweet about it, though, because it sends up the bat signal for some people to get very angry about it. Yeah. But the thing with Nolan is he's so magnetic to these moments. And it's almost as though maybe he's not the guy who, you know, he's not the Larry Walker who's joking around and who's the buddy-buddy sort of type with reporters and with his public persona. And that's Larry Walker's personality. He's my favorite baseball player of all time. I love that about Larry Walker. Nolan's just a different person in that this is all just genuine fire from him. This is just the way Nolan is. The screaming, the theatrics, all of that stuff is nobody plays the game more in the moment than Nolan Arenado. And that's what you want in a leader in any type of sport. But to have it now, to have it with this team, to have it in this moment, to have it with this coaching staff, with this manager, and with the fact that 40,681 people are showing up for a Thursday afternoon day game against the Diamondbacks at Coors Field, this is a moment. And that was the moment that Nolan took ownership of this roster. And there's a reason why franchises are built on athletes like this. Nolan may be the best, by the time it's all said and done, that's ever put on a uniform and played at 20th and Blake. But he's also, in my mind, the first guy who's really embodied what you want that centerpiece of a franchise to be. Because behind yes. closed doors, he's that way. On the field, he's that way. With the media, he's that way. And Nolan is just a genuinely good person. I mean, you see, and yes, these are team-required things and all that, but Nolan does the charity stuff. He's at Children's Hospital last week. He's doing stuff with kids. He's just a very good dude. And that's not a knock on Todd Helton. It's not a knock on Dante Bichette. It's not a knock on Vinny Castilla, whoever it was. But those guys were always different. It was always they always had a different identity. Dante Bichette played places before and after he was in Colorado. Todd Helton was never the type of guy who was going to be, yeah, he had some funny Rockies baseball commercials, and there are always good stories about Todd, but Todd Helton isn't right. winning any charisma competitions. This is just a different breed right now. And with the type of ball that this team plays, Nolan is the perfect guy for the perfect moment for this team.
Yeah. And it helped out that the next game, you know, eighth inning, Rockies down by one, two runners on, he knocks a triple off the wall to give the Rockies a lead. I mean, it was an unbelievable run of a couple of games there for Nolan Arenado. And we'll talk to Mike Farron about this later, but is the NL MVP this year going to come down to Paul Goldschmidt versus Nolan Arenado? There's a very, yeah. very good chance that it could. This could be the year that Nolan finally breaks through.
Yeah. I really think that it's right now that is the race, and there's always going to be Corey Seager's going to be in that discussion. I think Cody Bellinger is probably sure. going to be in that discussion, even though he didn't come up until sure. a month into the season. But it's, man, who else is going to be? It's like
Bryce
a
Harper,
yeah, maybe
you know,
Bryce Harper
be in there, of course.
It's like a six player race and five of them are from the National League West, which is amazing. Yeah. I don't know, that felt like a massive moment. It felt like a big sea change in what the organization is to be about for 2017 and beyond. And that, I mean, that was huge. The Rockies finished off a sweep with the Giants. And yeah, then it's frustrating, but they get the victory in big fashion in the opener against Arizona. They come back to get that win. They blew a lead in the top half of the eighth inning. They come back and get a win in the opener. And that one, that was a 4-3 final in which they came through in the bottom of the eighth. And that was Nolan again. Obviously. But this just, it's the latest thing on a laundry list of why this feels different this year.
Yep.
And that's fun as hell. So that's where they stand right now. The Rockies will head into the series opener with the Dodgers tonight at 47-28. The Los Angeles Dodgers are currently leading the National League Division, West Division, at 48-26. That's a game and a half up on both the D-backs and the Rockies. D-backs are 46-27. They've played two fewer games than the Rockies, so they're technically a little bit above Colorado in terms of winning percentage. So if the season were to end today, which it doesn't, the D-backs would claim the top wild card spot. The Rockies would visit Arizona for the National League wild card game. Either way, it's going to be a fun three-team race as this season continues moving along and gets heated up in July and August and on into the stretch run. And with that, we'll talk with a guy who knows maybe more about the National League West than anybody else on the entire planet Earth. Mike Farren of MLB Woo. Network Radio and the Arizona Diamondbacks joins the show coming up next. Our guest this week, one of the guys who really has to lower his standards in order to join this terrible podcast, is Mike Farren, the pre- and post-game host for the Arizona Diamondbacks, as well as one of your favorites on MLB Network Radio, and somebody we've had on the podcast now several times, and I don't know why he continues to do this. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Well, I have low standards, so it's just like my wife.
And thank God for that, Mike.
It fits in great with us, obviously. Those are the only people that we can land are people with low standards. Let's discuss this first. Somehow, I missed you at Coors Field yesterday. I don't know what happened here.
Well, I don't always travel with the team, but when I do, I try and make sure that I don't contact you.
So okay. All right. Fair.
So a couple things. One, that was my first ever trip to Coors Field. This series.
What?
I'd never been before.
Really?
And it's a great ballpark, and I love Denver. I mean, Denver's a favorite city anyway. Lodo is really cool. Yeah. I mean, it's a great, and the atmosphere. I mean, gosh, 40,000 for a weekday afternoon game in June. That was really impressive. There were 115,000, I think, total between the three games. Wow. What great fan support, what a great ballpark, what a great atmosphere. And you know, we hear a lot about, you know, the best fans in baseball and all, you know, all this stuff. Listen, Denver is a baseball mad city, and it always has been. And the fact that even in, and because it's Coors too, you know, in a 7-run game, you know, or a 9-run game, it was 9-1 or whatever it was. Sensatella goes out and punches through his first 1-2-3 inning in the fifth. And the fans are going nuts.
People
went
nuts,
all right, we got a chance now because you put up a zero. Because they know that anything happens in that ballpark. And that was really cool to see. I mean, they were into it late. They stuck through a long delay the night before when an umpire got injured. You know, it was a really great atmosphere for that three-game series. And it was exciting. It was exciting baseball. That and here's the other part, and this is incredible to me that nobody has pointed this out to me, because you know I'm a Simpsons aficionado.
Yes. Sure.
The PA guy at Coors Field, Reed Saunders, sounds like Kang.
He totally does. Man, I've never thought of that.
This sounds like a Harry Shearer character. Which one is it? And he sounds like Kang.
Don't blame me. I voted for Kodo.
Don't you know it's a two-party system?
Oh, man.
You gotta throw your vote away?
Abortions for some, miniature American flags for others. Yay! Well, Mike, let's get into this. 40,681 on hand yesterday to watch the Rockies kind of get their throat stomped by the D-backs. The night before, 40,918 to watch the same. Over the last 2 days of that series, the Rockies were outscored 26-8, but came away with a win in the series opener. But as we said when we dialed you up, I don't think either of us, me or Anthony, thought that on June 23rd we'd be having you on the podcast to talk about a three-team race that appears to be really a race that will put all three in the postseason as things look right now. The Rockies and Diamondbacks are currently leading the National League wildcard race 8.5 games up on the next best team in the wild card standings. Has this surprised you this year, the way these three teams have played? The Dodgers, you knew were going to be good. The D-backs, you knew couldn't be as bad as last year with just everything that went as poorly as it did last year. But the Rockies right there have the second most wins in the National League right now. Has this surprised you this year?
Yeah, I mean, it has. I thought the Rockies, for most of last season, were a pretty good team. And I think the Story injury and then, you know, kind of some of the pitching wearing down towards the end and some bullpen issues towards the end of the year really had an impact on that. But if you had asked me despite what their record was at this point, you know, what I thought of them on June 23rd last year, I'd have said I thought they were the second best team in the division. The Dodgers hadn't really gotten going. San Francisco was playing extremely well. And I'd seen enough of Colorado to know that the lineup was really good and that their starting pitching was better than it had been. You know, fast forward a year, I guess I'm not surprised that Colorado is in contention. I'm not really surprised that the D-backs are in contention. I think I'm surprised at the win totals. You know, I didn't pick either of them to make the postseason before the season started. But, you know, they're both really talented squads. And while I think that they both have, you know, I don't know. I think Arizona was maybe a little bit more on firmer ground overall with depth than where Colorado is, or at least to the experience depth than where Colorado is. I don't see them as having as significant of flaws as the other teams in the National League that are chasing them. And so I think that puts them in really good position to, at the very least, you know, have two of these three teams with, you know, L.A., the D-backs in Colorado playing in a one-game playoff to determine who goes on. I mean, this is, to me, it became apparent about 3 weeks ago that barring catastrophic injuries, you know, this looks an awful lot like the National League Central 2 years ago, where the winner's going to be at 100 games and the other two are going to be at 95-plus and playing for a one-game playoff, barring catastrophic injuries.
Yeah, Mike, this is going to be my point because we're going to talk about this on the podcast today, but really of the three teams, the D-backs, the Rockies, and the Dodgers, I think the D-backs have the fewest flaws. They've got the best rotation. The Dodgers are kind of piecemealing it together with a lot of guys who have a long string of injury histories. The Rockies have a lot of unproven rookies. They got to need some bullpen help as well. The D-backs, they kind of have everything going. They have the offense. They have the rotation. The back end with Bradley and Rodney has been really, really great so far. Trade deadline's coming up. What do the D-backs need to improve their team, get them over that hump?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're kind of in a luxury buyer situation, right, in that they don't need to necessarily add something significant as it stands now. Now, you know, again, a lot can change in a month, so who knows what's going to happen,
sure,
you know, a little bit further down the road. But I think as it stands right now, I think these, you know, this front office has been through pennant races in Boston and Chicago, and so they know kind of what you need. And I think starting pitching depth is one thing that any team is always looking for, even if it's just somebody to get you innings, to just be an improvement over what you have at AAA. I think that that would be one of the focuses that they have right now. I think the other thing is a right-handed hitting outfielder who can, you know, play all three outfield positions, most likely. Somebody who could really crush lefties. That seems to have been one of the things that hasn't gotten going for this team yet. Although you would expect with, you know, if and when, or when, it shouldn't be if, but when A.J. Pollock comes back, that'll change a little bit. You know, Paul Goldschmidt obviously is Paul Goldschmidt, and I think Brandon Drury is starting to
see
it.
Never heard of Paul Goldschmidt here.
Yeah, I mean, it's
only in my nightmares have I heard of Paul Goldschmidt.
I think that most Colorado fans would like to expunge him from the history, right? So, but I think beyond that, you know, like Brandon Drury's really started to get going, and I think he has a chance to be fairly impactful against lefties too. So, I would say that those are kind of the needs, because you're right. I mean, this is the team that maybe, I don't know, maybe in all of baseball that's built the most traditionally, right? I mean, it's like you need good starting pitching, and that they've gotten. I mean, they're, I think, third in the majors in innings from their starters, and averaging about six innings a start from that group. I mean, they have kind of a traditional closer and, you know, a fireman in Bradley, and then, you know, a lineup that's got a little bit of balance to it and can get on base and hit some dingers and also, you know, slap the ball around the field too. So I don't know that there's any like really pressing need the way the team is constructed right now, but I do think that there are going to be ways for them to improve the overall depth of the roster.
Now, Mike, you mentioned A.J. Pollock, and last year it was a big blow to this team when he got hurt right before the season started, hurt his elbow, came back for a little bit, wasn't the same, then got hurt again. And the team really suffered because of it, because you're playing guys like Chris Owings in center field who had no idea how to play center field at that time. You brought in the ghost of Michael Bourne, who actually did okay for a little while, and, you know, but you didn't have a traditional guy out there to do what A.J. Pollock can do. Now, this year, he did really well while he was playing. And then he got hurt again, but the team hasn't fallen off the way they did last year. What was the biggest difference for you to replace A.J. Pollock this year?
So I think one of the things that they deserve a lot of credit for, and I think this is the impact of Jared Porter, the assistant general manager, who was the pro scouting director in Boston and Chicago. Jared's a really good finder of talent, and he's the guy that loves 6 years and minor league free agents and non-tender guys. And there have been a lot of those guys that have helped the roster. Most of them have been in the bullpen. I think the single greatest depth addition was Gregor Blanco, who came into camp on a minor league deal and was hurt at the beginning of the year, too. Blanco got healthy just at the right time. And to me, Blanco's not an everyday player, but he's a 3 to 4 day a week guy who plays tremendous defense, who puts together great at bats. I mean, listen, you guys saw it for years in San Francisco. This guy is not your traditional championship caliber left fielder, and yet he was the starting left fielder on two World Series championships.
Right.
You know, I mean, and he's an energy guy. He plays good defense. He just does all the things that you want. And more than anything, he manages an at bat really well, and he's getting on base at a pretty high clip. He was hurt last year. You know, he jammed his shoulder, and that had a big impact on him. To me, Blanco has been as important an addition as they had, and wasn't a really active winter for them. But for him to be able to step in and give them what he's given them, even if it's, you know, 4 days a week over the last month while Pollock's been out, has been huge, and it's a big reason why they are where they are. I mean, he has scored, I think it's something like 55% of the times that he's been on base.
Wow.
I mean, that's like incredible,
that's absurd.
Right?
Yeah.
And so you're getting on base to start the game, and you're on base two or three times a day, and you're constantly setting up run-scoring opportunities for Goldschmidt and Lamb, who have had, you know, one of the reasons why they're at the top of the chain in RBI is because they've had a ton of opportunities to drive in runs. So, you know, that shows that, you know, RBI may not be a great evaluator of you know, what a player's true talent is, but it can tell you a lot about a team.
Mike, let's talk a little bit about, there are some similarities between the Rockies and D-backs that go beyond just on-field talent. And in, mm-hmm. you mentioned the front office and the new staff with the D-backs. The Rockies are largely in that same boat, at least in terms of the on-field coaching staff, with Bud Black being hired here. But the things that he has instilled in this team seemingly through the first two-plus months of the season now seems to be a really similar feel to what Torrey Lovullo and his staff have put together in Arizona. How do you kind of compare these two sides and the fact that they're drawing so much more out of these rosters than the previous administrations in 2016?
I think that there's a lot of similarities between both of those guys. You know, I mean, I've known Buddy for a long time, and Buddy's one of the finest people in baseball. He's, you know, you hear the term, you know, he's a great communicator, thrown around a lot. And I don't think it ever really gets explained, but he's constantly talking with his players. He's letting them know what he expects out of them, what needs to be corrected, what they're doing well. You know, as much as anything, he's easy to talk to. A lot of times he's just checking in to see how you and your family are doing. You know, that's Buddy. And that is Torrey, too. And, you know, I didn't know Torrey really at all until he took this job. And getting to know him over the last, you know, 3 months or so, what a tremendous person. And somebody who just really, really cares about people who, you know, who, regardless of who you are, I mean, he's interested in kind of what makes you tick. And I think that that's the strength that both of them have. And I don't think it's really any coincidence that they both came out of, you know, that Cleveland think tank, so to speak, right? I mean,
right.
That's where those guys got their start, and that's what you see, I think. I mean, it's, listen, look at the managers who get reputations at Grand, and how many of them come out of Cleveland, right? Those guys, Tito Francona in Cleveland now, Kevin Cash in Tampa, right? I mean,
yep.
All these guys have some
John
sort
Farrell.
Of, you know, so maybe he isn't quite the same communicator as those guys, but he's a really good development guy, you know?
Yeah.
And he came through that. I mean, I don't think it's any surprise in that regard. And really, you know, by extension, I mean, Mike Hazen worked with Torrey Lovullo in Cleveland. That's where they built their friendship. They have a tremendous relationship. Jeff Breidich, I know, has, you know, basically come from MLB and the Rockies, but Dan O'Dowd was his boss of the Rockies who came through Cleveland.
Right.
You know, I think that there's a lot of similarities in at least management styles from that standpoint, that even though there are very different personalities, you know, Jeff and Mike are not particularly similar, I don't think, in personality, but I like both the guys an awful lot. You know, one's Harvard, one's Princeton, so they've got that battle right
just
away,
like me and Anthony, basically.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
yeah, basically.
Nebraska versus Kenyon
just
College.
Like,
yeah,
my
big rivalry.
My favorite
there.
Is I just like to give Brian a turn. is a Scotty. You know, he's from Wisconsin, so that's no accounting for good taste, I guess.
Mike, let's talk about this because even though you're a D-backs guy now, D-backs pre and post, etc., you still are very much in the wider scope of Major League Baseball, in touch with everybody league-wide. And this Rockies team is such a weird anomaly this season in what they've been able to do, relying on basically 100% rookie starters is what it feels like. John Gray's been out. Tyler Anderson's been out. Chad Bettis has been out. This team, it feels like, has played with fire because they've gotten so much from guys that you really shouldn't expect this much from. Can that last? I mean, when you look at this team and you look at the way these guys have been, the last 2 days it's been rough, and Antonio Senzatella we know has scuffled a little bit over his last handful of times out. Jeff Hoffman, that seemed like maybe a blip on the radar screen compared to what we've seen from him. But when you're asking three, four rookies to do yeoman's work the way that they have, is that tenable long-term this season?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question, and I think the answer is probably no. I mean, I think that that's – you know, what our history is with rookie pitchers is at some point they're going to struggle. And they're probably going to struggle making an initial adjustment. It might take a little bit longer, which I think is what you're seeing right now with Senzatella. And then they're going to struggle with the sixth month added onto the season, which is understandable because you only play five in the minor leagues. And pressures change as you get, you know, this is getting into soft science type stuff, but you get to the end of August, you get to the into September in a pennant race, things are a little different. It's just a different feel when you come to a ballpark. It's as much about managing the energy that comes with it as it is with the pressures of being in a pennant race. So the one thing about this group is that they are really talented. And I think that that's why they've had so much success, is because it's not like these aren't like fluky rookies to me, you know, guys that come up and are just kind of, you know, it's not, you're not ending up with who's the Aaron Small, right? The Yankees,
yeah,
who wins
right.
10 games or whatever down the stretch 1 year, right? Like, these are legit guys. Like, Marquez, Hoffman, Senzatella, Freeland, they're pretty good major league pitchers. They're on the start of a big league career. And the one thing about it is I'm not sure how much they have to totally rely on them because, you know, I think Chatwood's going to pitch better. You know, they're going to get Gray back, you know, relatively quickly. You know, Tyler Anderson came back and pitched an inning out of the pen yesterday, but Anderson's another guy that I think is certainly capable of pitching better than what you've seen so far. He's already been through that rookie season, right? He went through that last year. So all of those things factor into it. And so, yes, they're right. It's surprising because they've been so reliant on rookies and they've had so much success. But at the same time, I don't think even if they just stick internally, if they don't go and add anybody from the outside, that they're going to get a little bit better production because they're going to have veteran guys that come in. You know, regardless of when Chad Bettis comes back, regardless of what his role is, whether it's, you know, they want to move him back quicker and use him in the bullpen, or they want to stretch him out as a starter, it's going to be a big help. It's going to be a big boost to their pitching staff overall. So I think those are the things that you look at in the positives. And then these rookies have gotten experience. And to me, this team isn't as good as it's going to be a year from now or 2 years from now. In part because they haven't gotten anything out of David Dahl this year, you know, who I think is one of their best players, you know. So I think that there's, you know, the arrow is really pointing up for this group. And I think what you've seen is the talent level of these rookies help to support that.
All right, Mike, it's, you know, end of June. Are we going to be talking about Nolan Arenado versus Paul Goldschmidt for NL MVP at the end of the year?
Gosh, I hope so. I mean, I think that that would be, to me, here's why I think this would be a great race, not just because obviously I subscribe to West Coast bias, or at least Mountain Time Zone bias.
What a guy. That's what we love to hear.
Arizona is a Pacific time now, but come on.
No, we are on Mountain Standard Time.
Yeah, Anthony.
Don't mess that up. Mountain Standard. So both of these guys are tremendous two-way players, right? So I think, so if you look at the wins above replacement leaderboard right now, Goldschmidt is like right at the top of the National League. And maybe that doesn't surprise you because he's a star player, but how often do you see first basemen that are there when they're the best base runner?
Yeah.
Clearly, he's the best base runner in the position and maybe one of the 10 best base runners in baseball. He's a double plus defender at first, and you add in the offensive expertise, you know? And so maybe he's a better base runner than Arenado. Maybe that's where the separation is. But these are guys that do more than just hit. And I think that that's what's exciting, is that they're complete players. But, yeah, I think that they're to me, they're 1-2. I mean, I would put, and granted, I do have a healthy amount of Sedona Red bias in this. Goldschmidt would be the MVP for me, but Arenado would be right there as well. I mean, I think they're both tremendous. They're tremendous players, and I really do hope that that's the case. Because, listen, I was excited that there was some national exposure for this series this last week, right? The MLB Network was talking a lot about it. There were a lot of articles written about the teams. You know, all of these things.
FS1, MLB Whip Around was talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's...
Sorry, it's a show I work on. Sorry. I'd get it in there.
Oh, right.
Get
he gets a nickel every time he mentions it. What? He gets a nickel.
Pete Rose gives
Watch
me a nickel
FS1.
Every time I mention the show. Yeah.
Watch FS1 so Anthony stays employed.
Thank you, Mike.
Anything I can do.
Mike, let's since we're on the topic now of those two, I will say that we take credit for turning the Coors thing on Twitter into a meme, because beforehand it was just people genuinely replying to every single positive tweet about the Rockies from MLB or ESPN or whoever with Coors, and now we've just decided to retweet everything in the world that ever has to do with anything even tangentially connected with the Rockies with Coors. But Chase Field is also offensively friendly. The two most offensively friendly ballparks in baseball are Coors Field and Chase Field. They have the two highest offensive park factors this year. Chase Field actually allows a few more homers on average than Coors Field this season. But it doesn't – when people mention Paul Goldschmidt, I don't see everybody up in the menchies for at MLB on Twitter saying Chase. What do you think the big delineation is there for people? Why is it that – I mean, obviously Coors Field has been around for longer. I think the fact that Coors Field really was the first one to ever just be a launching pad like that, which was aided by A, the steroid era, B, the fact they haven't really discovered the humidor thing yet, and see, those Rockies teams were fun at that time and got some exposure. Maybe that's the reason behind it, but why do you think Coors Field is such a joke to so many people and Chase Field kind of gets away with just being the other ballpark that's sort of offensively friendly in the NL West?
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably has something to do with the fact that Coors was, like, the offensive environment there was so much different than everything else that anything is going to pale in comparison, you know? It's funny to me to even talk about NL batting champions anymore, right? Because since Coors opened, was it like 11?
Yeah,
13,
something like that.
Like, it's more than it's half Rockies. Of the National League batting champions have been Rockies, right? So what is that? Well, that's Coors, right?
Yeah.
So I think that that's that. And I think the fact that there was a team with really good starting pitching that won a championship at Chase Field probably took some of that out of it. Now, granted, that was Schilling and Johnson. So I think that there has been this idea that you can't pitch in Denver. Right. I mean, that's a big part of this, is it's like, well, it's a joke of an offensive environment. And you can't pitch there. I mean, what was it that the previous administration called it? The thing or whatever they called the Coors? It was this huge, like, black cloud hanging over the organization, as opposed to, which I think this group has done, embracing what the challenges are there and using it as a home field advantage. So, I think that that's probably part a big chunk of it. But you're right. Chase is a great offensive environment. I mean, take a look at the difference in the D-backs home-road splits. I know the last 2 days probably did something to help alleviate that with the 26 runs scored at Coors. But for the most part, they'd been a below-average offensive team on the road and the best offensive team at home.
It's a 300-point difference in OPS. From the road to the D-backs this year.
I mean, that's and some of the splits on guys are pretty, you know, pretty crazy. Now, do I think that their true offensive talent is 300 points different on the road? No. I mean, I think it's a good offensive team, but it's a great offensive environment. And I think that that's so just to talk a little bit more about them, I think that that's the thing that's been most impressive about this team, is that their starting pitching has been really good at Chase Field. You know, they're number one in Fangraphs wins above replacement for a starting staff. And if you look at their peripherals, it's in line with what their ERA is. Their FIP is, like, right in line with it. I think they've been the top pitching staff on the road this year. And that, to me, is the part that's, like, that's the thing that if you believe in Arizona, and I do, I believe that they've got staying power, I think they're going to push the Dodgers the whole rest of the way. It's because their pitching is really damn good. And that's, you know, Greinke, Walker, Ray, in whatever order you want to put it, it's probably Greinke, Ray, Walker, is as potent a 1-2-3 rotation as you're going to find for any playoff hopeful.
Yeah.
And
if Patrick Corbin's your five,
right, Right. I mean, you see, you guys saw Zach Godley yesterday. That guy's been a revelation.
Yeah.
That curveball is unhittable. I mean, what Charlie Blackman did was ridiculous. You know, I mean, golfing that ball out. Like, that was a good pitch. Godley is really good. That's your he was your starting pitching depth. He was the guy that got optioned out 2.5 weeks ago with a 2.50 ERA because they didn't have a spot for him. So I think that's the thing about Arizona that I look at is maybe the extreme is that their starting rotation is really good. It isn't just that it's pitched well. It's that the supporting numbers back up what their primary statistics look like.
I mean, in the National League, the D-backs have the best ERA of any rotation in all of baseball. Or in the National League, they're the second most strikeouts, one of the best opponent averages. They had the most innings pitched, or third most innings pitched. Like, it's hard to say that team shouldn't be the favorite to win the NL West. I know the Dodgers are hot right now, but they haven't played anybody during their hot streak. They played the Reds like 3 times and the Mets, you know? So I think that the D-backs are the most talented team in this race.
I think they're going to push the Dodgers. I mean, LA's won the division 4 years in a row, so it's really difficult. And they are so deep. They're in much better position to withstand injuries than anybody else, and really in baseball. I mean, that's where they've spent their money is on depth. That when somebody gets hurt, they go to a guy who's basically a major league regular as opposed to going to somebody who's in the organization who's having a good year at AAA. That to me is, you know, that probably that helps them a lot over 162. But you're right. I mean, you start to look at some of those numbers and listen, I mean, it's a good, like they're good at key spots defensively. The D-backs are, especially behind the plate. And I think that's been a huge difference too. I mean, you've seen the growth of some of these young starting pitchers, but Jeff Mathis, Chris Iannetta, Chris Herman, that's a huge improvement defensively from what the D-backs had a year ago. And I think that's, you know, there's been a little bit written about that. I think Tyler Kepner just wrote about it in the New York Times too. You guys see it with, I mean, like the Rockies pitching staff has pitched pretty well, right? I mean, that's like overall you go, that's pretty good. Well, Tony Walters is a pretty good catcher.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's a big reason. Ryan Hannigan is a big help in that regard. You know, like those guys, I had one guy who I think is a really talented evaluator tell me just within the last week, he's like, man, he's like, just look at how important catcher defense is to making a pitching staff better. And you start going through and looking at B-Pro's lists on you know, like which teams are the best at framing or in the catcher metrics or getting the best, you know, defensive war or warp from their catchers. And almost all of them are playoff teams. Almost all of them. And that's huge. I mean, think about that. Like, we would be having this conversation 15 years ago would have been laughable, right? Ah, it doesn't matter, really. You just need offense out of the position, right? Yeah. No. We have a much better understanding now of how important catcher defense is, and we have better ways to quantify it too.
Mike, there is an elephant in the room in Major League Baseball this season, and being that the two of us are sort of tangentially employed by Major League Baseball, it's something that I guess we have to toe around, but home runs have been up a bit, shall we say. There is a tweet this morning from Ned Coletti. There is a home run every 26.9 at-bats in Major League Baseball this year, and one of every 6.8 hits is a home run. Jason Stark then noted one out of every 7.2 fly balls is a home run this season.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's a lot of discussion about guys who are swing paths are different. Guys are trying to elevate and lift and hit the ball in the air and all that stuff. That doesn't explain this jump. What's going on?
Well, I mean, I think that's part of it. I mean, I do think that's a big part of it. I mean, listen, there's no smoking gun. I thought Ben Lindbergh's piece on the Ringer this week was pretty good. You know, he and Mickey Lickman went back and looked at a bunch of baseballs. And so is the ball juiced is the question that keeps coming up. The answer is no, the ball isn't juiced. But are there more balls that probably fall within the framework of what is acceptable for the baseballs that are maybe towards the more offensive end? Well, it could be. Huh. I mean, there's a pretty wide framework of weights and measures and circumference and all these things and seam height that fit within MLB's parameters.
Interesting.
And even so much as just a couple of you know, like tenths of ounces can add an extra mile and a half to exit velocity. And I would think that's probably what we've seen is that, you know, I don't think the commissioner is lying when he says, well, no, these balls all fall within the parameters. That's probably true. It's just that the parameters are probably falling in an end that's more offensive in that regard. I don't believe in conspiracy theories generally, so I don't think it's necessarily by design. I think it's probably just whatever happened in manufacturing has helped to cause that. But I would say that that's probably, maybe 10% of it. I do think the guys trying to hit the ball in the air is, pretty significant. I mean, we've seen the focus in the last decade be on what? Pitching, defense, not just shifts, but defense overall, right? Run prevention is huge. Well, what's the best way to combat run prevention? Hit it over the boards. No one can catch it.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that there's a fundamental change in that. And I think it's going to be up to, smart teams and smart pitchers to figure out how to combat that to close this cycle. I mean, the cycles are moving much faster in my mind, or at least these last couple have. We went from the high octane PED era. It took us, almost 20 years to get to the really good pitching era. And then all of a sudden, midway through 2015, that stopped. And now we're on this offensive uptick. Normally you've seen like 20, 30 year cycles. This one was like 10. And I think how quickly, how much does objective data collection, how much do analytics help to change the equation to make these cycles shorter? Because now it's like a copycat. They always talk about the NFL being a copycat league.
Right.
Well, this is more like a chess league. Is you're trying to figure out what your opponent is doing and how do you stop it? And as soon as one person does it, then everybody figures it out, right? As soon as somebody figures out how to pitch to Aaron Judge, everybody's going to be on that same plan until he makes an adjustment. Well, now it's going to be up to the pitchers to find an adjustment to combat what's high offense. I think you're starting to see more use of a curveball. I think you're seeing guys work north and south because that can help impact, what their swing path is. I think you're going to see more high fastballs. I mean, that's the Dodgers thing, right? Their bullpen throws a ton of high heaters. I think that there's a lot of different things that are going to go at work to try and limit that power, and the teams that get the most ground balls and keep the ball in the ballpark are going to win.
Every time we have him on, speaking of chess versus, in our case, checkers, we're the mental checkers players, and then there are people like Mike Farron who are the mental chess players because Mike is the greatest. You can find Mike on Twitter. He's at Mike_Farron, and he's way too good to be coming on this podcast, and he continues to do it because he's a good man. And thanks, buddy. This was awesome. We'll do it again.
Well, it's great to talk to you guys, and if I am playing chess, I'm playing the chess that's in Star Wars, and I'm the piece that's getting eaten.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, guys, take care.
Our biggest thanks, as always, to Mike Farron, who, again, you can find on Twitter. He is at Mike_Farron, F-E-R-R-I-N, and he's the best.
He is.
I love that dude. And unfortunately, he had to waste part of his morning by hanging out with us. But he's a gentleman for doing it. And
apparently someone who was leaf-blowing their yard.
Yeah, right? And he was, like, beeping his way into, like, a secure area. I would imagine he's at Area 51 or somewhere. There was a lot of good background audio.
Yes, there
Mike
was.
Today. It was good. So go find Mike on Twitter. He's the greatest. Okay, so last week, We sent up the flag for your Ask PDP questions, and then we just neglected them entirely.
Completely forgot. It was not intentional. I didn't even realize until later that night. Like, oh yeah,
Ask PDP. We ran out of time, and we also had a lot on the show last week. We'll get started on Ask PDP. We'll go through some of the ones that we got today, and then we will dive into some of the ones that we got last week. But we'll get started with our good buddy Hayden Ringer. We discussed this a couple of weeks ago when we did the episode from the party deck, but just to take it in Ask PDP form, and because I think the question has changed right now, the answer to this question has changed. Give us your best 5-man Rockies rotation, assuming everyone is healthy. So again, the contenders are, assuming everyone's healthy, John Gray, Tyler Anderson, Chad Bettis, the three that we've been waiting on for some time. Chad Bettis, it looks like, is all systems go to hopefully returning to the staff at some point this year. John Gray should be back soon. He's made will make his second rehab start with the Albuquerque Isotopes coming up Saturday in Albuquerque. The return of Tyler Anderson has already been culminated. He's back with the Rockies, and Chad Bettis, it looks like, will be very soon. Kyle Freeland, Antonio Senzatella, Jeff Hoffman, Herman Marquez, the four rookies, and then who am I missing?
Your face.
Oh, well, I mean, we know that's the ace on this staff.
Yeah.
Hi-o! So that's really the group. Oh, and Tyler Chatwood. That's the one I was missing.
Yeah.
Of those guys, of those eight, who gives you the best let's say it's September 1st and you got to build a five-man rotation to push the Rockies past the D-backs and the Dodgers and win this division, who are you going with? Who you got?
Gray, number one, obviously. Yep. That's an easy one. I think Tyler Anderson. I think people give Tyler Anderson a really bad rap for whatever reason on Twitter. I think he's going to be just fine.
Tyler Anderson had four very good starts all in a row before he struggled against the Mariners in that last one where the knee flamed up on him.
That's the difference. I think he had a real, real good stretch before that. He'd figured it out against Arizona, Los Angeles, Cincinnati, and Philly. He dominated a lot of those games.
In those four starts,
very, very good.
He struck out 32 and walked 7 over those four outings, and he dropped his ERA from 7.71 to 5.40. I mean, that was a legitimately very good stretch.
And everyone keeps giving him a lot of grief on Twitter, like saying, oh, take your time, come back. I like Tyler Anderson.
To break it to people, but that's going to be a common theme going forward. Now that this disabled list is 10 days, teams are going to massage and manipulate that disabled list to put guys on it and take guys off of it who they can work into the rotation and out of the rotation because that's how baseball works. I hate to break it to you, but when guys go on the disabled list, sometimes they're not actually hurt. Sometimes it's a paper move. And I'm not saying that that was necessarily the case, but even Thomas Harding, the Rockies beat writer for MLB.com, said, look for the Rockies to use that 10-day DL to their advantage, whether it's with Herman Marquez, who dealt with the thumb thing, or if it's Antonio Senzatella, who maybe will conveniently have some fatigue because he didn't pitch a lot last season, that type of thing. That's not a knock, guys going on the DL. That's a clever way to use your roster. The Dodgers showed that last year.
Yeah, so I think it is Gray. It is Anderson. Bettis, I'm not going to put Bettis on there because it's hard to say where he's going to be September 1st.
I think that's
1st.
Fair.
It's very hard. So then I think that Jeff Hoffman should be there. I think Herman Marquez should be there. And I think if it's on the road, Tyler Chatwood should be there.
Okay, so no Freeland, no Senzatella.
I think Freeland, it's going to be hard for him to go through the whole season. And I think Senzatella is going to be in the bullpen sooner than later. And I think that's a good thing. I don't think it's going to be, well, it's always kind of a demotion, I guess, necessarily. But I think he'll be very well suited to be in the bullpen in that Archie Bradley kind of role.
Okay.
I think that he's not going to get a lot of swings and misses anyway, but he has the amazing stuff. He can get 99. He's got a good slider. But if he starts, he tries to throw too many pitches, too many different pitches, I mean, obviously. And I don't think he needs to. I think if he can go into the bullpen, he can start simplifying everything about his game. And I think he can be a very impressive arm in that bullpen. Because the Rockies, they need the bullpen help as well. It could be very much a twofold thing. Senzatella has not looked very good over the last few starts. And I think it could really be a boon to him. And maybe not for the entirety of his career. Maybe this year's the bullpen, and then maybe next year come into spring training as a starter again. Could be great. But I think for right now, September 1st comes around, I think he should be in the bullpen.
Yeah,
Freeland I'm on the fence with, because I do like him a lot, of course. But you look at the guys with the best major league stuff, and it's Herman Marquez and Jeff Hoffman.
Yeah. Well, John
Gray. It's all about
you mean of the two at the back end of the rotation?
The rookies, basically the best guys with the best stuff, Marquez and Hoffman. It's inconsistency with them. Obviously we've seen that. Marquez looked great on Tuesday. Hoffman looked great for three innings, then didn't in a big way.
Yeah, not fun.
But if those guys are on their game, I think they are the most unhittable. They both got 98 in their pocket.
I think that's fair.
Easily with knee-buckling curve.
I'm also a little baffled as to why everybody's so down on Tyler Anderson, but people haven't really jumped off the Antonio Senzatella bandwagon yet. I love Senzatella. I had him picked at the beginning of the season on the Minor League Baseball podcast as my National League Rookie of the Year contender, surprise National League Rookie of the Year contender. But over his last five outings, it has not been good. The ERA has gone from 3.19 to 4.79. 9 runs on 8 hits yesterday over 5 innings. 5 runs on 6 hits over 6 innings to start prior to that. 4 runs on 7 hits over 4 innings to start prior to that. He hasn't given up fewer than 3 runs in any start since May 26th, and that start against the Cardinals in which he went 8 innings. And he's only given up fewer than 3 runs that start out of every outing dating back to May 14th. So it hasn't been a great run for Antonio Senzatella as of late. And I think something that we talked about last week is he's got the stuff to be very successful in the bullpen because he has 2 very good pitches. The fastball is outstanding. And if you're only working on a fastball and secondary pitch mix, that works a lot better in the bullpen than it does in the rotation. And with that slider, go for it. You can throw a changeup and use that to keep people off balance, but when you're in a bullpen role, that works. When you're a starter and people know that you're coming at them with 94% fastballs or whatever it's been for Antonio Senzatella this year, oftentimes it's not going to work. The fastball is great. It's very effective. But would it be that much better in a relief role? It's possible. So I think that's also fair.
Yeah, and last night was kind of the first game where Senzatella didn't have his best stuff and really had it snowball on him.
Yeah.
You know, he's got head starts where he has his best stuff. He's gone 5 innings and he's given up 4 runs. He's gone 6 innings, given up 5 runs. Last night he went 5 innings, which is surprising. He went 5 innings. He had to wear a little bit of that, but he gave up 9 runs on 8 hits, a couple of home runs. It's 5 home runs in the last 2 starts too. That's not what you want.
I agree. Okay, so those are your 5. Let's move on. Barish Azbe, who is one of our good pals on Twitter, he's been a follower for quite some time, asks a question that we sort of discussed last segment. Quote, are the rumors true that Chase Field is really just Coors Field in a clever disguise? I say yes.
I think that is definitely yes.
Absolutely.
All right. So from our friend at Bishop KM, the guy with the horse head on Twitter, Kyle. Expectations weren't this high for the Rocks before this season. How badly would the Rocks have to finish the season to declare it a failure?
I mean, missing the playoffs this year would be considered a failure. That in any context would be considered a failure. You start the year with your best 70-plus game start in franchise history, and then you don't make the playoffs. That's it. The thing that I find interesting—
You've got this lead here, too, like, you know, the lead in the division / wild card.
They're 75 games into the year. They're 47-28. It's a .627 winning percentage. FanGraphs right now has the Rockies projected to go 43-44 the rest of the way with a negative 10 run differential, because we know how important that is, and finish the year 90-72. Now, that would still put them into the postseason as the second wild card team, but, I mean, we just talked about the Rockies' schedule throughout July. This team isn't going a game under .500 the rest of the way. Come on.
I think if they go .500 the rest of the year with all the rookies in there,
I think we'd be okay with that. If this team won 90 games while basically starting 4 rookies for the majority of the year in the rotation, I think everybody would be fine with that. They're on pace right now for over 100 wins. I don't think they're going to get there. No. But if you win 90 games, if you would have said coming into this season, the Rockies are going to give legitimate starting time in the rotation to 4 rookies on a regular basis, and they're going to win 90 games and make the wild card game, people would be ecstatic about that. I don't think there's any reason to complain about that, but I also don't believe that this team is destined to be a .500 or worse team going forward from this point. If they miss the playoffs, that to me is a failure, and it's going to be a massive collapse from where they are right now, because they're 19 games over .500. They've been up to 21 games over .500. If they're going to miss the playoffs, that means you have to finish, I would think, 83-85 wins. And that's a huge collapse from where they are right now.
Yeah. So, all right. From Johnny Schaub, how much salt in my water for boiling pasta? Also, how does one tell when your noodle is al dente?
I love this one.
In Italian, al dente means to the tooth. So really, it's just a little bit of give back when you try to bite a noodle. And that's how you know it's al dente.
And also, the other thing that I think you have to keep in mind is you don't want to get it perfect when you take it out of the pot to the tooth, because it's going to continue cooking a little bit more as the noodles mix with each other. You throw in some olive oil, you throw in some parm, whatever it is, it's going to cook a little bit longer. So you kind of have to bring it out like the step before it's perfect.
Yeah. You don't want it done when you take it out of the boiling water.
This is what you don't do. You don't throw it at the goddamn wall like some white person.
What? Why'd you throw it at the wall?
Haven't you ever heard of that?
No.
If you throw it at the wall and it sticks...
No, I'm Italian. I don't do that.
Dude, we're the exact same amount of Italian. We're both half Italian. I'm Italian also. If you throw it at the wall...
I've never heard of this before.
Well, then you haven't hung around enough white people, which is weird because you're going to marry
a
non-Italian white person.
College. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's true. That is
a lot of white people there.
But the idea is if the noodles stick to the wall, especially spaghetti, then people think it's ready. Which is the dumbest thing. I remember the first time somebody explained that to me in college, and I was like, what in the hell are you doing? So don't do that.
My walls are gross. I don't want to do that.
I know, right? That's the other thing. Like, ugh, why would anybody want to do that?
And for the salt, it's like throwing a bunch of Tylenol at a
I'll disagree with that only in that salt helps water. It helps water boil faster, which at altitude is a big thing. So in in Colorado, I'll deal with that. If I'm making pasta in New York, I'm probably not going to salt the water that much. But in Colorado, like, I'm impatient, and water takes too long to boil here. So I throw in – I mean, I go, like, let's say 6 shakes of the salt shaker.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it seems like a lot. But it's a big pot.
Yeah. Sure.
You know, because I always weigh – this is the other problem with me and pasta. I make way too much because you look at it when it's dry, and you're like, oh, man, I could eat a pound of this. And then you make a pound of pasta, and you're just, like, handing out pasta to, like, neighborhood dogs and stuff. Like, I got to get rid of all this. It's ridiculous.
It's like 2 weeks later, you're like, please eat this pasta.
Yeah. Yeah, it's absurd. Yeah. So there you go. Those are my favorite questions, by the way, the ones that we get that have nothing at all to do with the Rockies. Ryan Bloom asks a very good question that I will pose to you, my co-host and good friend. Quote, more critical to Nolan's MVP chances, a better personal season than the last two or the Rockies winning the division?
Rockies winning the division easily.
I agree.
I think he puts up the same number as he did last year. He's kind of had basically the same season each of the last 2 years.
Yeah.
If he does that again with the Rockies being in the national conversation, making the playoffs, I think his chances improve exponentially.
Completely agree. And it's not fair, but I think that's the only reason that you're going to get recognition from. I mean, I think Nolan has put himself on the map over the last few years because of the defensive work. If Nolan was just cranking out 40 homers and leading the National League in RBIs, nobody would care because it's Coors Field. But the fact that he has done so much defensively that's gotten him on top plays and has gotten him on MLB Network constantly and whatever,
right,
that's what's put him in front of people's eyeballs. But the qualification that the team that you're on has to be good for you to win an MVP,
that's already out the window. Mike Trout won it last
right
year.
That's true. And I mean, there have been players in the past. Larry Walker won an MVP on a bad team.
Alex Rodriguez
won an MVP on a terrible team,
last place team.
I think there's more leeway for players who have that hype, which Nolan probably now is one of, but he still has the Colorado and Coors Field factor. So the offensive numbers aren't going to carry the weight. The Rockies have to be – look at what Matt Holliday did in 2007. He was the MVP of that year, but Jimmy Rollins got it because Jimmy Rollins played on a better team season long than he played in an East Coast market.
Yep.
So that it has to be a good team, and it has to be a team that thrives on Nolan and is this good wire to wire. The Rockies can't fall out of contention in August and then storm back in September and just expect that everybody will have paid attention the entire season long to see what Nolan did and how he was critical to this team.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. From Benny at Benny Trill. How much stock do you put into power rankings?
Zero.
Yes, exactly. That is exactly true.
no stock whatsoever. I think power rankings are fun, but they're kind of they're the sports media version of a BuzzFeed listicle. Like, it's just there for you to click through and get outraged about.
Yep.
Plus,
it is just content.
MLB put the Rockies at number one, and then they lost 2 out of 3 to the Diamondbacks. So obviously, it's a jinx. You know.
Cool.
It's the only explanation. Jared Benefield says, "Who are some of the bullpen names or starters the Rockies could be interested in before the deadline? What pieces or prospects would they be willing to move in return?"
Oh, well, who are the relievers who are going to be on the block? Could be David Robertson.
Kyle Bearclaw.
Ferreira.
Could be one.
Kyle Bearclaw.
The thing that's so weird is right now, it's starting to come into focus who is going to be sellers. But we're not entirely sure about that. We're hearing a lot about the Marlins now. The Marlins are all about selling. They got a lot of pieces. Maybe Christian Yelich is going to be available. Maybe some of these other guys, Kyle Bearclaw being one of them, are going to be available. Maybe Marcelo Zuna is going to be available. Stanton seems to be the only one who's untouchable on that roster. But do we know that for sure? Do we know that team is going to stay out of contention? Yeah, probably.
Right.
But we're not positive. And plus, that team is like, they're trying to read the tea leaves with the Marlins in that front office. Nobody can figure out what's going on there. The Pittsburgh Pirates, it looks like Garrett Cole is going to be on the table. I don't know. The thing that worries me about this, and I made this point with Ron Otaro on his show, our guest last week, what the Rockies will sacrifice in acquiring somebody big. Say the Rockies wanted to go out and get Jose Quintana because he's under team control. He's not just a rental for the rest of the year.
Sure.
They're going to have to give up a ton. That would require the type of haul that would give up, you know, Riley Pint and Ryan McMahon Dom Nunez, something like that. If you do that, your window shrinks. Because right now the Rockies are planning on contending 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, whatever it is, with these guys arriving in waves. Ryan Castellani could get here soon. Parker French could get here soon. Riley Pint will be a little ways behind those guys. Peter Lambert will be a little ways behind those guys. Yency Almonte could get here relatively soon. But those are the guys that you're counting on coming in to bolster the pitching staff. If you have to part with those guys, the window shrinks a little bit. If you have to part with somebody like, I think Brendan Rodgers is untouchable. I don't think there's any way they deal Brendan Rodgers. But if you have to part with somebody like Dom Nunez, another catching prospect the Rockies have been high on for a long time, or Ryan McMahon, or Colton Welker, somebody like that, I don't see the payoff in that being big enough. If the, and it may be very different. Maybe we get to the All-Star break and the Rockies have opened up a 5-game margin. It's only like 2 weeks away, so probably not. Maybe we get to the end of July, let's say, and the Rockies have opened up a 5-game margin, and you think by the deadline, if we make one piece and we get one big guy in who can take a spot in the rotation or can take a spot in the bullpen and push us over the edge, and that's what we need, then maybe you do that because the ultimate goal is winning a World Series. But I think when you are a team like the Rockies, you have to be more mindful of the fact that these windows open and close very quickly. The more talent you give up from the system, the shorter that window becomes.
The Rockies should know. I mean, they haven't been to the playoffs since 2009.
Right.
So,
yeah,
it's tough to see, especially with the AL so bunched up right now. There are, what, 8 teams within 2.5 games of the second wild card spot in the AL? I mean, it's 2 very different leagues this year. The worst team in the American League is the Oakland A's, and they're only 7 games back of the wild card spot right now. I mean, that's not that much. The Cubs are 8.5 games back from the wild card, and they're the third best team in the wild card standings.
I really hate to say this, but I don't think the Phillies are going to make it this year. I think the Phillies might have to start thinking about
22 games back. I think they might have to start in the wild card standings.
Thinking about 2018, maybe. The Giants and the Padres are probably in that same boat at 20 and 17 games out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's a different animal. And the fact that you're in this division right now makes it that much more. If the Rockies were in the National League Central right now and they were leading the division by 7 games, I think you feel pretty comfortable to maybe not necessarily stand pat, but at least to not overextend yourselves in what a deal might cost. But being that you're in a 3-team race, that makes it way more stressful down the stretch. Again, I'm very happy to not be the one making those decisions.
All right, let's wrap this up pretty soon. We've been here for a while. Let's get one from Oliver Howard last week. He had DM'd us. We actually met Oliver at the Coors Field at the Indians day game. We were up at the party deck, met him, one of our oldest PDP fans, finally met him for the first time. And he said, "Hey, I'm not always on Twitter. If you're doing Ask PDP, DM me and I'll send you a bunch of questions." So these are from last week. We'll go through a couple of these. One, what happens if Dahl comes back? Where does he play? Rapid fire here, Tyler.
Left field.
Do you think they can sign Mark Reynolds for a minor league deal every year? Seems to work out for him.
Might as well. Sign him to a minor league deal. Just give him a ton of money on a minor league contract. Minor league contract, $3 million a year.
Can we seriously get one of those 99 problems but a pitch ain't one shirts for real Z's?
We could probably make that happen.
All right. Which player on the Dodgers and Nationals would do the most good to Tanya Harding as tarnish is a verb here, Tanya Harding, as to guarantee the pennant? So which player do we have to clip in the knees? We could get some galoolies out there.
It's got to be Cody Bellinger at this stage. Although if I think because Bellinger is the more hyped one now, I would say Corey Seager. Because Corey Seager is really damn good. But I don't condone violence, and I actually really love watching Corey Seager.
Yeah, but, you know, also, did he ask enough questions?
Yeah, you know, I think we got a good mix in.
All right, Oliver.
You're a good man, and we love you, and we love all of you, and we love you for submitting your questions. Next week, we'll probably do more of the same with some Ask PDP. But no, I'm actually very, very excited for next week's episode. If you have not heard, and I think we mentioned this last week, but if you have not heard, there is a new podcast through WNPR, which is the NPR station in Connecticut, and it's called The Second First Season. It's from Jonathan McNichol, who's on Twitter, at McNicholPants, and not like McNichols Sports Arena, but at MCNICOL pants, and it is following the Hartford Yard Goats through their second season in existence. Hartford last year didn't open their ballpark, the big construction issue, yada yada. They played the whole season on the road. So the second first season is in reference to the fact that last year was their first year as the Yard Goats. This year is their first year actually in Hartford, but it is a fantastic podcast. If you've ever been interested in the very basics of what a minor league team is, how the front office of a minor league team interacts with the baseball operations side, how the player development side of a major league organization views what happens at the minor league level. You'll hear about that from players. You'll hear about that from some of our favorite people in the Rockies organization, like manager of player development, Chris Forbes, coaching staff, members of the Yard Goats coaching staff, like Jerry Weinstein, the manager of that team, Ryan McMahon, very heavily featured through the first couple of weeks before he was bumped up to AAA Albuquerque. It's a terrific podcast. We'll Jonathan McNichol on the show next week, because episode number 5 of the second first season will be dropping next week. So subscribe to that. Catch up on the first 4 episodes. You got questions you want us to bounce off of Jonathan, feel free to tweet them into us. PurpleDinosaurPodcast@gmail.com is the email address if you want to email us your questions. And this is going to be fun next week. I'm really excited about that one.
Oh, yeah. So it's a good podcast.
Yeah, it's good today. Episode. Big thanks to Mike Farron again at Mike_Farron. And a big thanks to you for tuning in. And a big thanks to you for being such a swell guy.
Me? What did I do?
Just, you know what you did, swell guy.
You old so-and-so.
We'll talk to you next week. Love you. Bye.
Bye.
Hello. That's how I sound eating cereal.
Oh, good. You're still eating. Great.
Actually, just started.
Oh, good. You just started eating. Great.
Trader Joe's O's. Honey Nut O's.
Oh, great.
They're good, man.
You're eating Honey Nut O's.
I don't know if you've ever had them. They're good.
Joe's I just O's. Had normal Cheerios for breakfast.
Oh, look at me, Mr. Bourgeois. I can buy name brand Cheerios. Cool. Better rub it in.
So I go about buying these name brand Cheerios because I have a lot of money.
Oh, look at me, Mr. Name Brand Cheerios, with my big Rolls Royce in my mansion.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty.
Think about it.
Much.
Think about it.
I have many times.
Oh, good. Keep thinking about it.
Yeah.